listening to Real Talk on RCR, Reality Check Radio.
Good morning, everyone. You're on Reality Check Radio, Real Talk with Rodney Hyde. Remember, you can send us a text at 2057, email us inbox at realitycheck.radio. We're joined by a very qualified nutritionist, PhD, no less. Can't get more qualified than that. It's Mickey Willardon. Good morning, Mickey.
Good morning, Rodney. Can I take this opportunity to say, back in the day, I'm not sure how long ago this was, actually. You will know better than I. But you were obviously in politics. I'm pretty sure you were on Dancing with the Stars. And I remember you having quite a significant improvement in your health. And yes. I just remember seeing this transformation. And whilst I'm not sure that I agreed with your politics at the time, just because I wasn't very political, so I couldn't even tell you if I did, I was so impressed.
Thank you.
You just took control of your health where others don't. And so ever since, I've been a bit of a fan, to be honest.
Oh, there you go. Well, that's kind. Well, you're off to a good start. and I'm a fan of yours.
Thank you.
Because you're an athlete.
That I am, actually. Yes, I'm an endurance runner.
I have such a lot of respect for athletes because it's literally something I can't imagine.
Really?
I was great friends with, or still am, I just haven't seen her for a long time, Lisa Tamati, who is an endurance athlete.
Lisa's amazing.
Yeah, and funny enough, I'm trying to think of her name. We had friends of my wife, and their daughter is a very fine trail runner, and she lives in Tasmania, and she came and ran the Root Burn, second woman.
Are you thinking, not Ruby Muir?
No.
Not Ruth Croft, because she doesn't live in Tasmania.
Yeah, she's young. She just started out. And yeah. Her mother was a Black Fern, Her father was an Olympian, Winter Olympics and something, ice skating, I think, speed skating.
Mm-hmm. Oh, amazing.
And athletes are something else.
There's definitely, something that drives an athlete, which does play, I think, put them in a slightly different category to other people. Yes. I don't know that I fall into that, but I understand what you're saying.
I feel the same about the military.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's not something I can imagine doing. And anyone that joins or has been a service man or woman in the military, I just have huge respect for, because it's just, to me, it's like another planet. It's like, wow, you do that. So tell me, first of all, about your athleticism, and then we'll get into nutrition. So tell me about your running.
Okay, amazing. So I'll go right back. I'm a twin. And when we were growing up, I felt like...
Identical?
No, very different. We were just two embryos in the womb at the same time, basically.
But a girl.
Yeah, better girl, yes. And so she
was... Because you feel a bit yucky sharing a womb with a boy. I mean, it just...
Well, I wouldn't know, would I?
No, I guess not. But anyway, boys. So with a girl, yes, you're a twin. Yes,
so she was very active, and she was the one that played rugby and was out running, and I was such a bookworm at the time. And, in fact, it wasn't until high school when I was, I had friends that had developed this interest in basketball. I'd played a bit of netball because, of course, I'm a Kiwi, so that's what you did as a girl. And I just thought, maybe I'll just get, I just want to hang out with my friends, so I'll play basketball as well. And I was so terrible. I was useless. And, in fact, our phys ed teacher and coach of the basketball team, who subsequently, he actually was at the same time coach of the New Zealand women's basketball team at the time.
Oh.
So he was very good. He said to me, Mickey, it's so good that you're trying at basketball. You're really good in the classroom. You'll never be good on a basketball court. And this was at the end of my third form year. And I just thought, Oh, stuff you, Mr. Dickel. I'll show you. So over the course, because I was a bit of a
Mr. chubby. Mr. Dickel. We'll blame Mr. Dickel.
Yes. Well, in fact, see, this could have been quite a negative experience, but in fact, it was the making of me because over the course of the summer, I, as a chubby kid, I went on a diet, which I know sounds terrible at the time, but it was a bonding experience with my mother and I, so it's just what you did. But I also took up running because I wanted to prove him wrong. I wanted to show him that I could be fit and that I could play basketball. And so over the course of the summer, I got fit, got a bit stronger, went back to school in fourth form, and subsequently, I mean, he was right, I was still terrible at basketball, but I could run. And I'd found something that I was good at outside of the classroom. And through running, I have just sort of formed my a lot of my identity. I love running. I've formed so many friendships over the years. My closest friends would be runners as well. And it's such a huge part of my life. Of course, my relationship with running has changed over time, but it is, I think, any athlete who has a sport that has really sort of helped inform them of who they are, I think there's really it holds a special place in your heart. And so that's running for me. And now, as an older runner, I suppose I'm 47.
Look, it's sort of a cliche to misjudge a woman's age, but that's astonishing to me looking at you.
Oh, I like you even more.
Yes. No, and you sort of speak a bit girly. So I was thinking, I won't say because it'll sound too ridiculous to listeners. Oh, my goodness. You've just blown me off my chair.
Oh, amazing. Maybe it's running or maybe it's good nutrition. Or a good balance.
Maybe it's both. Lifestyle.
Maybe it's both.
It's a good heart. Good genes.
Could be that too. Could be that.
All those things.
Probably all of those things, really. So so I'm much more into longer distance. That was a very long drawn out story of my beginning. And I've really done
that happens as you age, isn't it? Your speed drops away, but your endurance can go up.
Yeah. Yeah, it absolutely can. And I believe that there was just an ultra marathon distance run, 100 miles run, the Hard Rock, which is run out of Silverton in Colorado, just happened in the weekend. And the winning times, the winning female was 39, and she's an amazing runner. And the winning male's time beat a record. He was 49, I believe, 47, in his late 40s, like unbelievable. And, I mean, that's not my caliber of running. I'm so much more of a participant and enthusiast now. However, I do love a good marathon distance. My claim to fame, Rodney, if I can mention it on your show, is that I won the Rotorua Marathon in 2005.
That's
like
a great
20
claim.
Years ago, actually, but I'm still dining out on that.
I would dine out on that. If I ran it, no one would hear the end of it. That's amazing in itself because that's the competitive marathon. Yeah. Tell me, through high school, you were running. Were running competitively at high school?
I didn't have a Harriers Club. I didn't do track and field. We had an excellent social sciences teacher, and he, I'm trying to remember his name. He was a runner, and so we would have club every Tuesday, middle of the day, and so we would just go out running on Tuesdays. And I had friends who did orienteering. So it was very much
fun running.
Hobby. Yeah, yeah. And it wasn't until I sort of actually maybe got into my mid-20s and I thought I'll hit these longer distances and do them.
I find that fascinating because I've got three little kids and my wife's family are athletes.
Mm.
And my family, the opposite. Not that my family were unfit, but they didn't see sport as a thing.
Yeah.
They saw working physically as their thing. But with my three kids, because I've got an interest in sport, and looking after them, I've learnt that it's very usual for New Zealand children to burn out at 14, 15, 16 of sports, whether it be swimming, running, ski racing, because they tell me that the fun gets taken out of it quite early on, and it becomes very competitive and repetitive with the training.
Yeah.
So you actually, Ben, and Gary Moller, who we have on the show, says the same. He's a, he's 70-something, 74, I think. I hope I didn't misjudge that. But he still is, he's a world champion mountain biker.
Yeah, I don't know. I would love to chat to Gary, actually. I know who you're speaking about. Yeah.
So, and he didn't hit sport until later. By the way, if you're into running, I hate to blow my own trumpet, but you must listen to the interview I did with Lorraine Moller.
I'd also love to speak to Lorraine. She's amazing. Her book was phenomenal.
Well, the interview I did with her sent chills down my spine.
Really?
As she described how she got into running.
Yeah.
As she described what it was like to train as a runner, female runner, because it was back then, right?
Yeah.
And then I think she told me afterwards, it's sort of the longest talk she's had about her Olympic runs.
Oh, amazing.
And when she was talking, it was like you were there in the race.
I will listen to that interview. I imagine it's phenomenal.
But the spiritual and mental aspects of it all, it was truly beautiful woman, beautiful, beautiful story. So you did it for fun, not being driven by parents. It was an internal thing.
Oh, my parents were not athletic. My dad did a few star jumps, went for a few jogs, but he was very much into walking more than anything. And my mother was not at all athletic. So it certainly wasn't that I came from that sort of background. No. I was much more influenced by those around me at high school, I think.
And you're now what's called an endurance athlete.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this gets a bit of flack, maybe deservedly so, because people look at it and think you're mad, right? What would be your definition of, say, ordinary running and endurance running?
I think ordinary running is probably, it's a good question. Maybe you do 30 to 40 minute runs and then you target something like a park run, or you might do a 10K. Like 10K might be the distance that you sort of top
out. So a half marathon and a marathon running are starting to get endurance running?
I think so.
Okay.
I say this, I'm sure that I'm trying to think of what the actual definition is if you look at track and field, but that's how I would categorize it for the normal person.
Mm. Yeah. And this gets crazy, right? As I said, I know Lisa Tamati.
Yes.
And when I was an MP, I used to see her quite a bit. And she's a incredible ultra endurance runner, to the point of insanity.
It takes someone really special to do what Lisa's done, I think, and others in her category. I couldn't do it. In fact, I think my body would break down first.
Well, hers does.
Mm.
You know, her teeth give out. I mean, all sorts of strange things, because she will do like 100 miles or something.
Yeah.
In terrible conditions.
Yeah.
And when you chat to her, you realize that it's beyond a fitness thing. it's beyond a training thing. It's a mental thing just to keep one step in front of the other.
Yes.
When every part of you is saying stop.
And I think for personally, I'm not as mentally strong as that. And that's fine. Like I don't, like I
no, but you're,
like
but,
military thing again, you know, like what it really takes to do that.
She got into it because her boyfriend said she couldn't run or was a tits runner or something. She had a Mr. Dicker in her life too. Isn't that funny how we end up directing our life to prove some idiot wrong? You're running, so you'd run marathons and further?
Yeah, so I've done ultra marathons as well. In an event, the longest distance isn't actually that long. It's maybe 60K. But actually, you know what, Rodney? Like the events are great, but it's the training I love. It's the missions that we do. Like there's nothing better. So my husband's also into this and our friends are. And like it's nothing better than doing like a 4 to 5 hour mission, which is like a hike run. Like you wouldn't run the entire thing. Then ending up at a pub and having a beer and some hot chips. Like that's like the ultimate. On New Year's Day, that's what we did. We did a 40K run at Te Aroha. We did a loop, took 10 hours. We couldn't believe how long it took. Then ended up having a nice meal at the end. And and it's the camaraderie, it's the challenge, it's the relief, it's that your body gets you there. You have all of these feelings. And this is a slight tangent, but I really feel for people who do not get these experiences, who haven't sort of got the joy of being active the way that us active people get, you know?
I couldn't concur. I'm one of those and I couldn't concur more. You just have another level of living.
You really do. And it doesn't take doing ultra marathons to get it.
No.
And so many of us are inactive. And
I got it making it across the paddock in the ice this morning. I made it in one piece. No, I understand that perfectly. So is it tricky to train, like you're going off with your husband and friends, because presumably each of you has a natural, is it cadence and run speed, but if you're running as a group, you're sort of always adjusting a bit for the slower party.
You can be, but there's also an understanding, either sometimes unspoken, but you sort of set out at the start that, you know, we'll just run and we'll enjoy some, like the conversation will naturally ebb and flow, the speeds will ebb and flow, and then you have a like, you, if someone runs off, you know that you'll see them about 10 minutes up the road because they would have stopped and waited. So yeah, so it's actually, it's easy in that respect.
You must also have a great feeling of your body doing what it's designed to do and feeling a part of nature.
Yes, 100%. And I wonder whether people felt this even 100 years, like if you think about how society has changed. And as humans, we used to move so much more just in terms of having to live.
Yes.
We just don't have that anymore. So that physical weariness.
Just seeing where people used to walk 100 years ago.
Yeah.
You know, walk over the Port Hills.
Yeah.
Walk over to Macetown from Arrowtown. Tough walk for anyone on a good day. But they did it just to get home.
Amazing.
What are you training for now? Are you training for something? Are you looking ahead to something?
Well, so we want to do Boston Marathon next year. I have a qualifying time for that, but husband doesn't. So we were both training for the marathon, but I've got an injury. So he needs to run a good time at Sunshine Marathon in about a month's time, Sunshine Coast. So I was training for that as well, but I won't bother doing that.
Okay.
Ultimately though, actually what we have in our calendar is the Southern Lakes Ultra mid-February, which is a 6-day stage race. And
that's down here, right? Around Queenstown?
It is, yes. Yeah, it is. And so
was that the one where, was it a year or two back, they had a bad weather event and had to, and some people got exposure and they had some problems.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, that's the one.
Well, that's a big, hard run.
I know. And so we are, we were planning it actually in the weekend. We're doing it with a couple of friends. We're representing the liver unit at Auckland Hospital, actually, because my husband is a nurse practitioner. He works there, as do his two friends. One's a surgeon, the other one's works in the unit. So we're sort of raising awareness, if you like. And nice. And it's 6 days running between 20 and 70 kilometres a day. And you have to carry, we're doing it supported. So they will carry our big bags, but you just sort of carry fuel. And so we have to figure out, you know, how many calories a day we need and how do we fit it within the weight limit that they've sort of given us for the bags that they're carrying and all the rest of it. But ultimately though, Rodney, if I'm honest, this race is $3,000 and I don't want to default on it. So I have to get myself fit and strong and stay healthy in order to get to the start line. Because if you default on a marathon like I'm doing next month, it's a couple of hundred, which is not nothing, but it's certainly not 3,000. So I'm like, right, just got to make sure I'm good for that one.
What's the qualifying time for Boston for a woman?
So it's actually not in my age group. It's not that hard. For someone who runs, it's not that hard. It's like you have to run less than 3:50 for a marathon.
Okay.
And my qualifying time that I did in Auckland last year was like 3:26. So I'm good. I don't need to worry about that.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Wasn't it the most, I had to try to do the sum, wasn't it the most magnificent thing? Do you remember when Alison Rowe won Boston?
I don't remember it at the time, but of course, yes. Amazing.
Oh, I was trying to be a runner then. I got the wrong frame, but man, when she won that race, it was just, and John Walker and all the others too.
Yeah.
But she, there was something about Alison Rowe running that was beautiful.
Yeah.
There's that great ad that she did for Fish running along the beach.
I remember, yeah.
And oh God, she's so beautiful, that woman. So wonderful athlete. So we've got the athleticism away. Now, we're going to do this several times, listeners, but you've got a wonderful web page and a podcast. Tell us about your web page and podcast, please.
Yeah, so I have a so my podcast is called Micopedia, and it is an exploration of health, fitness, longevity, nutrition, all the things related to what I'm passionate about. And you know, Rodney, it's almost like a selfish endeavour, really, because it provides me an opportunity to reach out to the likes of the Lorraine Mollers, the Gary Mollers, you know, and scientists and experts in their field to have a conversation. So so I feel really lucky that I've sort of got that avenue to those people. And it's what I try to do, and I do this through my web page, but also, of course, on social media, is translate science into information that people can understand and also interpret, because there is so much misinformation out there in nutrition, partly media-driven, partly just driven by agendas of other people that are confusing. And so, and of course, how I sort of frame my what I talk about is of course based on my experience, my interpretation from other people I listen to, from the research, and my clinical experience. So someone else may have the same qualifications and the number of years in the industry, yet have a different opinion because of the lens they look at it through. So so I always, you know, I'm really mindful of that.
How do we find that podcast and webpage?
So Micopedia, you can go on Spotify, on Apple, and search it. It's Wikipedia, but with an M, basically, two Ks, that's my name. And then my Instagram and my, which is where you get a lot of information, and, of course, my website where I have, you know, plans and consultations available, Mickey Willardon, so my name.
Okay, M-I-K-K-I.
Yes.
New word, W-I-L, is it two L's?
Yeah, two L's, I-D-E-N.
Mickey Willardin. It's a wonderful name. Where does Mickey come from?
So my full name is Mikala.
Okay, got it.
Yes.
It's
yes.
Okay, it's enough. I love Mickey. I love it. It's a beautiful name, Mickey with two K's. Now, to the heart of the matter. You're a PhD in nutrition.
Mm-hmm.
You studied nutrition at Otago University.
Yeah.
What attracted you to study nutrition?
I think probably my obsession with diet and exercise. And so I studied both.
Chose diet. You did both at the start and then specialised in nutrition.
Yeah, yeah. So in my third year at university, I realised, because I tried economics and I tried English, because I thought, you know, I was good at that, so I'd do those subjects, but they were so boring that I then thought, right, I'm just going to follow what I really want to do and do physical education. Did that in my third year and continued on. But I had friends and they were like, you need something else because you don't really want to be a phys ed teacher, do you? And so they were like, come and do nutrition. So that's how I got into nutrition.
And why a PhD?
Because I'm a geek. I love learning. Yeah, I love looking at research.
Okay. Now, let me put on the table my abject disgust of expert nutritionists.
Oh, please.
They have led us up a garden path for 50, 60 years.
Mm-hmm.
Eat this, don't eat that. All nonsense.
Mm-hmm.
Public health. Sort of politicized. Even putting aside COVID, just heavily politicized.
Mm-hmm.
Climate change,
mm-hmm.
sugar taxes, rather than just research. Am I wrong?
No, you're like 100% correct. It is all agenda-based.
It's terrible.
Yeah.
And people have... My wife was a sportswoman. She was a squash player.
Amazing.
She followed the nutritional expert. They had a dietitian to the mm-hmm. nth degree. Destroyed her.
Mm.
Because it was low fat, low fat, low fat, low fat, low fat, low fat. And, you know, cornflakes and fat-free yogurt for breakfast. Piece of toast, no butter, margarine, and ended up totally washed out.
Mm-hmm.
And we now know, I think, that's why I'm looking at you, do we know this? That was a shocking diet for an athlete.
And recommendations for athletes haven't changed a lot, Rodney. And it's not a diet that's based on health. You cannot be a good athlete if you're not healthy. So first and foremost, athletes are human, and we need to have nutrients to support overall health. But that diet was based on the premise of carbohydrate fuels performance, but at the absolute expense of nutrition, actually. So yes. Certainly not high enough in protein, which is like a vehicle for a ton of micronutrients, but also, of course, fat. So I agree with you on that front. And, of course, look.
Well, I'm not loving you because you agree with me, but it's interesting because still these days you have stepped out of what we would call the narrative.
And isn't that interesting? Because it's not like the research isn't there. You know, and there are also what I feel – happens is that you get stuck in a way of doing things. And I will say that when I came through my science degree at university, like I was very, very much blinkers on to anything else, any other information, because I thought, well, I learned this at Otago. This is like the place to get your nutrition degree. If the other knowledge was important or real, you know, around grains, around the importance of fat, etc., I would have learned that. And that's the opposite of what I learned. And it wasn't, So I feel like people who are sort of, who are educated through the university system are almost, it's harder to change your views because of that sort of, I used to call it arrogance. I don't think it's arrogance anymore. It's just, it's, I don't know what it is, but yeah, it's.
Did you find it gut-wrenching?
When I was studying it, or when I
learned? When you realized that you were being misled.
So it was interesting, actually, because as a clinician at the time, we would attend talks on sports nutrition, for example, as one avenue of my practice. And you would know the sports nutrition recommendations, but it was almost like a secret amongst clinicians that, oh, you never tell our people to do that, though. Like, that's like far too high in carbohydrate. People just gain weight then. So that was, you know, as I worked with a lot of endurance athletes, that was a primary concern, was, of course, you know, having an like optimal body composition, which it would be for most sports. But so we sort of knew that the carbohydrate intake that they were suggesting was well higher than what most people can sort of tolerate. And even if, actually, if you look at literature, habitually speaking, athletes might be recommended 7 to 8 grams per kg body weight in my space, in the endurance space. But even the elite would only manage about, you know, 4 or 5 grams per kg body weight. So
there was this advice out there that was, if you like, the official advice.
Mm.
But behind the scenes, the experts were saying, God, no. Well, and actually, endurance athletes were saying, God, no.
Yes, actually. Like, and not everyone, for sure. Mm. Like, there will be people who do not notice a negative impact of the carbohydrate intake at the time of their sport, notwithstanding what it's like for them now, like beyond sport years. Like, that's another conversation about metabolic health for these athletes. But there will be people who could tolerate and do that fine. But yes. I, in my experience, that was a small percentage, particularly with people who, you know, your general endurance athlete that is out there training for a half marathon, training for like a marathon. Like, it's, yeah, they're, the recommendations for your general person is, you know, I think they need to shift more towards a different approach, which is the approach that I talk about.
So animal fat is good?
Yes, 100%.
Because that's the vitamins.
It's vitamins, and it's, you know, it's natural. Like, I always go back to, you know, where possible, minimally processed. And animal fat, such as butter, I mean, of course, butter is processed to get the fat out of the, you know, the milk or whatever. But, you know, you've got butter, you've got cream, of course, you've got coconut oil, you've got fat that's naturally occurring in foods. This is how nature intended. This is how we should be consuming these foods. To cut the fat off meat, and for people who are in energy balance, and that's a different conversation, like mm-hmm. whether you need fat loss or you're in energy balance, to recommend margarine, like, and to say that vegetable oil and canola oil are the preferred fats just blows my mind, actually.
Wow. You would know then about the ketogenic diet and endurance runners that are big believers in becoming fat burners rather than sugar burners for endurance training.
100, yeah. Yeah, and I advocate for that too.
Oh, like, really?
Your body, even the leanest individual, has hundreds of thousands of calories that they could be burning from their own fat stores. Because athletes store fat in their muscles. I mean, as do non-athletes, but non-athletes, that's dysfunctional. But for athletes, that's a ready fuel source. And if you rely on a limited supply of carbohydrate to get you from A to B, you're going to tank pretty quickly. Mm. And then you're going to have to rely on exogenous
sugar water.
Fuel. Yeah. And look, I'm not saying there's not a place for carbohydrate in endurance sport. Of course there is. But the current recommendations and what many people are suggesting should be targeted, like 90 grams of carbohydrate an hour, is too much. And there is research to show that people who they term middle-aged endurance athletes, so they might be in their mid-30s, they're actually quite young, like we can see that when they shift to a high carbohydrate approach, they've got blood sugar profiles that mimic what a pre-diabetic person would have.
Yes.
So it's just not appropriate. Whereas fat is a clean burning fuel source. It provides plenty of energy, and as an endurance athlete, that's what you need. The people who do best in endurance sport, they're not necessarily the ones when they compete in an event. They don't speed up at the end of their race. They are able to maintain their pace, and that requires the steady supply of fuel that can have that sort of foundation in burning fat.
So you have eaten a ketogenic diet?
I have, and I've settled more personally on a low-carb, higher-protein approach.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because that's another funny thing, isn't it, that people find, nutrition now is like what religion used to be, an argument, or whether you were a Ford car man or a Holden car man, or whether you were a Presbyterian or a Catholic. These were sort of die-in-a-ditch arguments.
Mm.
And we have these arguments now about nutrition, whether you're a vegetarian, a vegan, or an animal eater or carnivore, whether you're ketogenic, whether you're low-fat. And these things become tense.
They do. And, everyone eats, so everyone has an opinion.
Yes.
Information is so readily available now, and it has so many benefits, but also just means that misinformation is so much more rife, I think. Mm. And so...
Have you been back to see Mr. Dickel?
No, I haven't, actually. I'm not sure he is anymore. So do I, actually.
What are you telling me that you learnt this studying, or it was the dirty secret that people who were in the field had? Like, my impression of nutritional advice coming out of Otago University is not what you're telling me now. Am I wrong or right about that?
I believe you're right. Like, I don't know that the curriculum's changed much.
So you've stepped outside. What caused you to step outside?
So when I was a senior lecturer at AUT University, I worked with my colleagues, Karen Zinn and Grant Schofield, and we were interested in a concept called metabolic efficiency. And that was meaning it was talking about the ability to burn both fat and carbohydrate. And so whereas, we were beginning to be aware that actually for athletes, if they're sugar burners, they're going to tank out pretty quickly. So it sort of started there. Alongside that though, Rodney, I was also aware of Sarah Wilson and her I Quit Sugar movement, because I had many clients sort of say, Nikki, what about this? And I hadn't really given it much sort of creed, but I just started, and all of us at the time just started investigating outside of the parameters that academia would have, sort of provided. But upon saying that, though, there is so much research in this, research papers, and showing these, not alternative, but these different narratives for nutrition, but it's very easy to ignore if you're not looking for them. So at that time, I remember quite clearly, actually, I'd missed my flight back to Dunedin for Christmas, and I was just having to glance over Sarah Wilson's book, her I Quit Sugar PDF, and this is before she blew up and became super big. And there was something she said in the book really just sort of was like a light bulb moment. And it was so clear to me. She said, if you're putting in artificial sweeteners in your body, then this is just, this isn't food. These are chemicals. And it's not like I hadn't heard that before. And it's not like I haven't heard of it since. And it's not like I never now consume, moderate portions of some things. But at the time, it was just the thing that made me go, holy crap, And so I took the Diet Coke and I took the extra chewing gum and I binned them. And then I just went full on paleo, actually.
Oh, nice.
Like lots of people do. You know, it's almost like you go from one extreme to the next and then you find your middle ground. I feel like that's what we all did in that space at that time.
Mm. And, of course, the explosion of the internet has opened the field up to influencers and to people that have knowledge, and you can go on the internet and pick your way through different diets, and which hitherto you didn't have really access to as a lay person. So people, if they want to research a paleo diet, or it used to be just, oh, there's a book come out on the Mediterranean diet, and it was, that was the book of the year, so that's the book, that that was the diet everyone was following. Go on the internet and there's a million ways, and hot wars over paleo versus Western A price versus vegetarian, and quite funny and quite bitter. This metabolic efficiency interests me because I was of the understanding that your body only had two phases. You were either burning carbohydrate or you were a fat burner. And in order to become a fat burner, you needed to be ketogenic, which is basically to eat 80% fat, because any little bit of refined carbohydrate will just hit your body as sugar and it's got to get rid of it. So the insulin shoots up and you're into sugar burning mode, and that your body would shift over 3 days to become ketogenic, and it was one or the other. But what you and your colleague Grant Schofield and another lady whose name I misplaced were researching was, tell me her name and tell me this more about this metabolic efficiency, because that's a combination, right?
It is, Rodney. And so Karen Zinn is...
Karen Zinn. How do you spell that?
Karen is spelt with a C, A-R-Y-N, and then Zinn is Z-I-N-N.
Got it.
And so your body actually, we don't burn either fat or carbs. We're burning both all at the same time. And it's just... So that's physiology for you. So you will be burning fat and a small amount of glucose just sitting here. Yeah. So it is, but what metabolic efficiency, so the concept that you're talking about is like metabolic flexibility. So the ability to shift from predominantly sugar into burning predominantly fat and vice versa. And most people who eat a standard Western diet would predominantly be sugar burners because of, again, what you describe, like their diet will suppress fat oxidation. So, so they're still burning a bit of fat, but like minimal compared to what they could be. Whereas metabolic efficiency works on, well, first what you do is you go, right, let's start by being by trying to get this efficiency. So let's get you burning fat. And for that to happen, you do need a lower carb diet. Now, you don't necessarily need to be ketogenic, but you absolutely need to withhold carbohydrate.
Yeah.
So we need to deplete your muscle's glycogen stores or muscle carbohydrate stores. And it's in that glycogen depleted state once your liver, where is another place where we store carbohydrate, once that sort of burns through the glycogen stores, then your body has to start burning fatty acids. Now, a ketogenic diet makes it easier in some instances because, of course, you're taking on board dietary fat, so that's going to be a ready fuel source. And, of course, you've got medium-chain triglycerides and other ketogenic-based foods that can promote the burning of fatty acids and the production of ketones. But it essentially over time, your body becomes able to burn fat, even in the presence of carbohydrate, actually. But there is certainly a run-in period. And for some people, this can be 4 weeks. For others, it can be sort of 12 weeks. But actually, what you do want is you don't want just metabolic efficiency. You want to be metabolically flexible. Your body wants to be adaptive and resilient in a lot of different diet environments. And so you, like, when, let's say you are eating carbohydrate, you want your body to be able to appropriately dispose of that. And you don't want your blood sugar and your insulin to go sky high. You just want like a you want it to be stored for later use in your muscles. So,
and that's the paleo experience, because some days the men would come home empty-handed from the hunt.
Yes.
And they'd be relying on the women folk and the kids who have been collecting nuts and berries.
100%.
And so we are historically omnivores.
Yeah.
And so it would be odd. I always felt that about the paleo, that the idea that we traditionally ate meat and fat and offal wasn't borne out by the work done on the Kalahari Bushmen, who were, to be fair, living on the edge, but the woman and the kids did most of the calorie collection.
Yeah.
The men would talk about hunting all day, and they'd go out and come back eating empty-handed, and they'd sit down and, oh, it's berries and nuts again, fellas. So this is so interesting to me. And, of course, we're suffering. I should say, I'm talking to Mickey Willardin, fascinating endurance athlete and nutritionist. I'm loving this. I hope listeners are. We're suffering, aren't we, as I understand it, from the aftermath of the fat-phobic fear, I've repeated myself, the idea that fat was clogging our arteries, animal fat was clogging our arteries, that we should rid ourselves of fat and eggs and bacon and all this stuff and butter. And the consequence of that was to go to a higher carbohydrate diet, but almost worse, or worser, to use an incorrect word, was to add in processed food in a box to get rid of the fat. And that's what we're riding the wave of now, isn't it?
Yeah, we are. And in addition to that, of course, is the exorbitant price of food for a lot of people, the lack of cooking and budgeting skills that people experience or are, you know, is their reality, like, and the cost of living in general, which means that people have to work two jobs, and, you know, like, there's just so many factors, Rodney, that are working against people being able to be in optimal health, if you like. Like,
do you think that's true? I'll challenge you on that, because I think we lack skills, because eggs aren't that expensive. Porridge is cheap. Butter is reasonable. And more particularly, as I've discovered, you can have your own hens. Eggs get cheaper. But isn't it that we look at kids having kits and they lack any skill of basic cooking, so they have to buy prepared food? And then more particularly, they lack any skill of gardening and looking after hens, so that you could actually feed a family well, inexpensively, if you had the know-how and prepared to put a bit of effort in.
So I did mention budgeting and cooking skills as lacking.
Yes, you did.
And what I would say, though, Rodney, I'll just push back a little bit on you.
Yeah.
That where would, like, I agree, all of that, 100%, that would be amazing. How, so the system is broken, isn't it? Because right now those people who did have inclination, who did want to, or, you know, learn more and then teach, like, they just need, like, where's the time for some of these people? And I guess that's the thing I wonder, like, if you are working, and this is not everyone, but, you know, if you're working, you know, from 5 till 2 in the afternoon, and then you're going to pick up your kids and run them around and to school sport or whatever, and then you get home and you're exhausted. Like, I don't know where they would find the time to learn the
skills. Because if I'm not mistaken, this was your PhD.
You are mistaken. My PhD was public health in boring corporate wellness, which is, you know.
Oh, corporate wellness. Oh, yeah. I'm sorry. But I thought you did it on obesity.
That my master's was on childhood obesity.
That's it. Yeah, I mistook your PhD for your master's, so I wasn't 100% wrong.
No, and even though, like, this is an area I'm super passionate about. 100%.
Absolutely, because what the hell has happened?
I know.
You see a picture from the 60s, 50s, 40s, 50s, and 60s. Not a fat person in sight.
It's amazing, isn't it? I agree.
When I went to school, there were 350 kids at primary school, Rangura Borough. I think it was 350. There was one fat kid. Mm. He wouldn't even be considered chubby nowadays.
That's the same when I was at school in the 80s and 90s. There were literally like two or three kids you could name. And looking back now, yeah, not.
You go to low socioeconomic, particularly Polynesian, high, struggle to find a slim child.
Mm-hmm.
What's happened?
It's from the food, but like the problem is, and I know that we're running up on time, but I will say that food industry did what government told it to. Yes. So the government said, we need to take the fat out of food. So the food industry did exactly what they was told, and they started making these products that were higher in sugar, that were didn't have the fat, and they were just sort of following the orders. And I'm thinking about from the United States, right, because that's where New Zealand's sort of policies are informed from. They're not that different.
The food pyramid.
Yeah, and now the My Plate and all the rest of it. So we've got this proliferation of these ultra-processed foods, which are cheap to make because they're made from flour, from sugar, from vegetable or industrial seed oils, which are very cheap, and there's just been a displacement of good calories in the diet. And now those good calories that we get from meat, from eggs, from dairy, from vegetables, not many from veggies, but, you know, like, they're all so much more expensive compared to the processed food, which is why people default to the things that they can afford on a week by week basis, because they don't have the time to explore how to produce, how to make a garden, or they don't have the money to set up to buy chickens to then have their own eggs, like, and they don't know how to budget appropriately. You're right, it's the whole system is screwed, basically.
And of course, this processed, ultra processed food is laced with sugar, salt, fat.
Yeah.
Which means bad fats, which means the sugar and the salt are just, you can't, it's like a bag of chips. You can't open a bag of chips and take two and put the bag away.
Hyper palatable.
That's the phrase I was searching for. It's a great phrase.
Mm.
And there's been much research on this.
Yeah.
And of course, if you're a company selling processed food, you want more to be bought and your food to be bought. So you make it hyper palatable. And if you get used to this as a diet, normal food or food doesn't taste good. You've actually got to be weaned. It's this stuff, I've heard it described as like crack cocaine, and for myself, I believe it. I've struggled with my weight my entire life. And to lose weight, I have to have this almost unbending willpower and think of nothing else but not eating. And I can eat the most terrible food. And when I start, I can't stop. It's a psychological thing, but it's also this hyper palatability. And then, of course, when you put on weight, you become lazy and you can't be bothered cooking, and on it goes. And, of course, this is spinning down generations.
Yeah, it is. And I would, one little beacon of hope, if we can end on this, Rodney, it would be that it takes 10 days. So you just have to
break the habit,
to break the taste, because your taste buds change. Things change. You change. Everything changes. And your tastes change too. So give yourself 10 days. This is universal you. And those blueberries that are bland right now will taste so sweet.
Yes.
You've got to get off the food in order to do that. And we don't even have time to talk about my favorite topic, which is protein, but that is like the thing that I could spend hours talking about and how it's so important.
Would you like to come back?
Yes, and continue and we'll talk, this conversation with good protein strategies.
Well, the child obesity, and I mean obesity generally, but child obesity is so cruel.
Yeah.
And apart from notable public health experts saying, oh, we need a sugar tax, we seem to be unable to address it. And, of course, saying to a fat kid, oh, you got to eat less and run around the park. And you're thinking, huh, so I only eat half my chips. That's not going to happen.
I know.
I'm morbidly obese and I'm going to run around the park. That's not going to happen.
No. And there are strategies that you can use there as well. So, yeah. Mm.
Well, I have to say, I have enjoyed speaking with you enormously, Mickey Willardin, PhD doctor in nutrition and athlete, endurance athlete. Your webpage can be found at Mickey Willardin. Just Google it and you will pop up, which is what I did. And you have a podcast, which I am going to listen to now because I like listening to podcasts at night, lying in bed.
Yeah.
And it's called Micopedia with two Ks. That can't be hard to find. And I think what you say then is you say, found on all your favorite platforms. Is that correct?
On all your favorite platforms, yes.
You have a wonderful day. You're training today or you're injured out?
I did a short cycle today and I'm just about to go and do a presentation to a bunch of students.
There you go. Amazing. Mickey, lovely to speak to you. We're definitely going to have you back to talk about protein, but also we're going to talk about your master's thesis and what you've learned doing that and what you've learned since about childhood obesity and some strategies that we could do ourselves for our grandkids and kids should they be tending to plump.
Amazing. Thank you so much, Rodney. I've really enjoyed the conversation.
Oh, you're the best. Lovely. Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Bye.
There you go. We're on Reality Check Radio, Real Talk with Rodney Hyde. You can send us a text at 2057, inbox at realitycheck.radio. Oh, my goodness. We're truly blessed with our guests, are we not?
Are you on the RCR mailing list? Never miss a beat of the news and hard-hitting stories you've come to know and love. Stay in the loop. Visit realitycheck.radio/email.